This is Thought Crime. I am your host, Jacob Fox, retired machinist and editor of PrescientSciFi.com. Today I'm joined by John Fox, director of Elevated Movement Records out in Colorado, and he is joining me so we can talk about the inevitable war against the machines. And this will be a two- or three-part kind of deal where we just talk about the general fear we all have that we're going to have to fight a war against the machines and we're probably going to lose if, you know, all the Hollywood movies are any indication. So this first part's going to be on, we're going to kind of divide it up with like the specific things you see in movies and TV and, you know, the specific threats that machines have for us. And so this episode is going to be on automation and, or what you could call the WALL-E scenario. If you've seen the movie WALL-E or you've seen the movie Idiocracy, you know what I mean, where technology and things reach a point where people don't have to really think or do anything anymore. They just sit around, become fat, lazy, and whatnot. And also just some of the other problems with, you know, when machines take over work from us or start doing the thinking for us, you know, what the hell do we need to do with all our time? So that'll be the topic for today. But first, we have to talk about what we are drinking. So, John, first off, hello, and what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Fort Collins beer, which actually Fort Collins, I think, was second in line for the best craft brew city in America. That's in Colorado, about an hour and a half north of where I am. People in Colorado like to say it's just a little bit over an hour north, and I think that's because they really like to violate the speed limit on 25 and just cruise up there. But let's be realistic. It takes about an hour and a half to get there. You guys are all breaking the law.
From Denver.
Okay. It's just a straight shot, just right up there.
And it literally is called Fort Collins Beer or Fort Collins Brewery, or does it?
Oh no! Hold on one second. It's called Easy Street. It's Odell Brewing Company. It's a wheat beer, and it's quite delicious. It's quite delicious.
Excellent. And is it? I haven't heard of it. I'm assuming it's probably one that's only available in Colorado, you'd say, or do you not really?
No. Odell Brewing Company, I think, is distributed, not necessarily completely coast to coast, but I know they have distribution outside of Colorado. It's one of the larger breweries and probably one of the ones that got Fort Collins on the map. We could also mention New Belgian Brewery, which has the national favorite Fat Tire beer.
Excellent.
Which is based out of Fort Collins and New Belgium is one of the largest Colorado breweries that isn't technically a Colorado craft brewery anymore because they do have places outside of the state that do their brewing for them because they're that big. And Odell Brewing is kind of another one on par with that that also has brought a lot of great notoriety to Fort Collins. And one of the reasons why a lot of new craft breweries are there and like to hail from Fort Collins, and also why it probably won its award. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I just heard it's like second on the list of the best craft brewery cities in the country.
I did not know that. I'll have to look at. I do love Fat Tire. That is fantastic. They do have it down here. I think it is now distributed nationally. It is a fantastic beer. New Belgium in general makes really good stuff. I'll have to check that out. I think that's probably the only, Fort Collins beer I've had a chance to taste since I have not come out to Colorado at any time recently. Well, I have what's called Dark Cloud. It is a Munich style Dunkel Lager.
Ooh.
It is made by Mother Earth Brewing in Kinston, North Carolina, and that is in the rural part of the eastern part of the state. So in North Carolina, there's breweries all over the state. They're not really, they are kind of concentrated in the Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro kind of corridor in the middle of the state. But there are also breweries in Charlotte, Asheville. There's a couple in Wilmington. And then there's a couple that are just out in the middle of nowhere. And this is one of them. Kinston, I think, has a population of 7. And this is actually a common beer. You can get it all over Raleigh. I don't think it has much distribution beyond North Carolina and Virginia. It's a dark beer, but it doesn't taste like a dark beer. And it is a Munich style. And I love Munich style. It's by far, I think, I love Belgian and Munich style. Those are my two favorites. So this is actually a pretty solid beer. It's on the dark side, but it really, I mean, it just doesn't taste like it. It's not putting me to sleep. So it's good stuff.
Do you have a alcohol content on that? ABV, alcohol by volume.
All right, let's see. Where is it? ABV is 5.1%. And this has been aged 3 times longer than the ales. So I don't know how long the ales are aged, but... Oh, yeah, and some trivia. Lager just means to store. And Dunkel just means dark in German. So not really kind of special names here. So basically, Dunkel Lager is dark, dark in store, or dark to store. That's all it means.
Do you think maybe like stored in the dark?
Yeah, they keep all the lights off. I guess that's what they do. I think it's because they have it sit there longer is why I think it picks up more color. I don't know. I don't know anything about brewing beer. I will have to look into that. I have a few friends that are trying to brew their own beer now, and the first few batches were pretty terrible. But
well, let's continue to speculate so we can mislead our audience.
All right. They actually use a different species of hops and wheat that has actually been in the industrial areas of Germany where they don't have any air pollution laws or rules. So a lot of the soot and the coal and a lot of the other dirty kind of carbon emissions fell right into these fields. And, you know, they have to make beer. So they harvest it up and they serve it up. And that's why it's darker. And also why it has about 400 carcinogens in it. So that's my theory.
Yeah, I got nothing. I think my beer is delicious and there's nothing bad about it. And I think Odell Brewing Company should send me any samples that they want me to try about their beer so I can tell how delicious and perfect they are and how they're not that.
Yeah, also to Mother Earth Brewing, I will recant all of that if you send me a free case. All right, back to the subject at hand, and today it is automation. This is where machines take over the jobs of men and sometimes women. And the movie that I wanted to cite, because it's kind of the one that scares me based on what I see around me in America, not so much the world, but kind of more America, is the movie WALL-E, where if you haven't seen it, it's an awesome movie about a robot that finds his way to who lives on Earth, and Earth is a wasteland, and he finds his way to a spaceship that's full of the survivors of Earth, and they're all humans, and they're all really fat. They can't stand under their own power. They spend their days in leisure because all the computers and all the machinery of the ship take care of everything for them, almost to the point where if they want to go, like, you know, hit a few golf balls, they travel on their little chairs to the driving range, and then a robot hits the golf ball for them. And that's basically the point they got, where they know they're basically useless. They don't do anything. The machines and robots and computers do everything for them. And they've gotten really just obese and, you know, a lot of the things that... And so I've kind of seen that in the U.S. a little bit. We do have an obesity problem. We do have an issue with staring at our cell phones or computers and not really paying any attention to anything that's going on in the real world. And, you know, a lot of people are replacing, you know, physical sports with playing, you know, Madden on the internet or things like that. And also just, you know, communication, you know, people talking over the internet or texting. I mean, I've gotten emails from people, even though they're right down the hall, or text messages from people in the same house. And it's just stuff like that. I mean, and also in the movie, there's a scene where these two guys are in chairs next to each other and they're talking to each other via Skype rather than just turning and talking to each other because they're sitting 5 feet away from each other. And I don't know, it kind of struck me. And one of the other stories in science fiction, the classic stories that kind of plays this out to its inevitable conclusion is H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, where he goes about 200,000 or 400,000 years in the future, and humans have become these weak, stupid, childlike species on the surface. And then underneath there are the Morlocks, who kind of harvest them for food and kind of take care of everything for them, but the people on the surface are none the wiser. So anyway, that's what we're about. It is a fear of mine because of what I see in America. And I don't know if you, John, kind of feel the same way or if you see the same thing.
One second. Well, I mean, I really do want to comment on everything you just said, but I just the way you started it was like, you know, automation taking jobs away from, you know, men and you know, some cases women or whatever. I think it would have been a little bit more PC or whatever if we, you know, from people or human beings. So that was kind of funny.
Yeah, the name of the show is Thought Crime. So
yeah. So you expose a lot of how you think.
Yes.
Anyway, but of course, to go on to that, I think that those fears are extremely realistic. And you know, Wally was an awesome extreme for a lot of ways. But, you know, if extreme automation was actually designed like that, I mean, it's not necessarily that far from the truth. Not necessarily that far from the truth, but something that is possible. But the other example in the time machine, I feel with that one, and you know, maybe it still applies to the Wally one, is that, you know, they had designed them essentially to be their food, and so maybe those people in the future aren't necessarily as smart and as free thinking and as able to process everything that's happening as much. You know, everything is provided for them, yes, but maybe they, you know, are a little bit de-evolved as far as their cognitive thinking. So I, you know, don't always like that example. And then also with the Wally one, even though I think that is something that's possible, I mean, I think the way to, you know, avoid that is through education. I'll go into more detail with that.
The time machine, you said de-evolution. That's actually, I mean, that's spot on what H.G. Wells, that's why he put it like 300 or 400,000 years in the future.
Uh-huh.
Is he wanted to make an evolutionary case that I think the term that they kind of use in academic circles is entropy or atrophy or something like that, where a species that has become the dominant species and has no rivals will start to get, will start losing some of its evolutionary traits because it no longer needs them. I mean, I think some of the examples are like some of the species on the Galapagos Islands are like the giant tortoise, which if the giant tortoise was on any other continent, it would be extinct because it cannot evade a predator for anything. It's extremely slow. But on Galapagos Islands, it has no predators. There's none there. And I think that was kind of what Wells was. And Wells was also very negative about his people. I mean, he was a turn of the century Englishman and he saw industrialization and he kind of felt like there was something being lost with all the, you know, people going to factories and doing all these tedious tasks. So it is similar to kind of how what people are afraid of today with automation, in that it's going to just do all the work for us and there'll be nothing left for us to do with our time. But it was definitely a de-evolutionary story and a classic.
And that's why, like, I think it's definitely like an outlook that we should have as a potential, like, you know, extreme that could happen. And, you know, us having this conversation as well as, you know, other people having this conversation and talking about the extremes that might happen and how it could destroy, I don't know, what it may be seen, what it is to be human or what we think civilization should be. So we should definitely expose ourselves to these extremes, but I mean, we should obviously try to avoid them, but also, I mean, let's talk about the way that our society is now and maybe some of the things, if they were continued to happen, why we're kind of like, you know, on that path.
You mentioned education, and I really was thinking, I noticed that we used to get all these pamphlets and people would come into our class in elementary and middle school and talk about nutrition and the food pyramid and all these other things about the exercise and they spend, you know, schools and government programs, they spend a lot of money on trying to educate kids on eating right, exercise, whatever. And yet the obesity rate continues to rise. And that's why I was going to ask you, like, what, I mean, it seems like we do try to educate people, like, for example, just on nutrition, you know, just not turning into fat slobs. And yet we don't seem to be making a lot of progress on that.
Well, one of the things is we thought we were actually kind of taught nutrition correctly. And when you look at the food pyramid, it wasn't really designed by, you know, scientists and nutritionists, as you might think. It was more designed by the USDA and by, you know, agriculture, like conglomerates. What is a huge agriculture?
You talking about Monsanto?
No. I mean, I guess like the USDA, and I think there's like, another, you know, organization that's a special interest group for like agriculture groups for the entire country and stuff. For them, it was almost more like, you know, like the amount of commodities that we want to push on people and the way that we want people to consume stuff and not necessarily related to, what we should actually be eating. And the fact that when it really comes down to it, everyone could potentially have an individualized diet anyway. So a lot of that stuff that we were fed about that isn't, you know, necessarily even true about health and nutrition, let alone the fact that, you know, at the schools, we weren't even given those options. And even at the time, as well as them trying to give us those values down the throat that weren't even the right ones, they didn't even give us the options to even be on the better curve of that. But talking about, you know, the de-evolution of like education is maybe there's not as like, as much accountability, kind of like what I'm talking about, of whether, stuff works or not, whether our education and whether we end up getting better. It doesn't really matter.
It does seem that information is plentiful on just about everything, but that doesn't really lead to better results because the people that are the authority seem to be wrong quite often. I mean, I remember some of the crap I was told in elementary school about all sorts of things, about friendship, about nutrition, of course, also the environment. I don't know how many eco crazy documentaries and movies and things they had us watch and all the stuff that my science. At the time, I called him a science teacher, but now I know they didn't know jack about science. They just that they were an elementary school teacher that was told to teach science. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist and say that this was all kind of contrived and this is all just to serve their ends. I mean, some of that might be true, but I think it's just more they believe this stuff and they just don't really care about doing any kind of the rigors to see if it's really true. Cause I mean, a few examples, the ozone thing. We were told about the ozone being depleted back when we were kids. The ozone is nowhere near depleted. It's 2016 and it is nowhere near depleted. I was told when I was younger, we were running out of landfill. That was 100% bullshit. We had to recycle or we were going to run out of landfill. It was total nonsense. And I think with the food pyramid, like you just said, it wasn't really based on good science. It was based on, you know, alternate interests. Everyone's saying, well, if we're going to teach kids this and it's up to us to teach kids, we're also going to put in our 2 cents on what we think they should eat, even if there's hardly any science behind it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that kind of is unfortunate about our education system, that some legislators, especially in different areas and regions, feel like their version of the truth is subjective to what they could convince their voters of or what they could like put through, you know, the school. And it doesn't necessarily have to do a lot with the truth. And not to say that everything that you learn in school is bad or whatever, but it's just very unfortunate that there's agendas that are outside of, science, and it's more having social agendas. And I think that's one of the big culture shifts that would have to change, that if, you know, automation was going to improve our lives, we would have to have a culture shift that have our education more based off of facts and logic and science and not necessarily off of culture and tradition and or fear.
Yeah, especially if food now you can get whatever you want. I mean, the grocery stores in America have everything, and Europe, I know they have plenty of food. I know there's plenty of places. I'll cut you off.
Like, no, they don't. Most of Middle America does not have access to like really good natural food. It's mostly all like processed and crap. I mean, most of Middle America doesn't have calories.
I mean,
doesn't have the access to, you know, the actual food that like we're all supposed to be eating will actually make us all healthy.
True. I was talking more about famine, and I was thinking the obesity issue of having.
My bad. I'm sorry. No, the quality.
Well, there is some evidence that that some of the foodstuffs that are processed are contributing to obesity, not because of how much people eat it, you know, in terms of quantity, but because of what it does to your digestive tract. And I wish I did a little more research on this particular part, because I know a lot of. And just to kind of carry this all back a little bit, I mean, 100 years ago, almost everyone was involved in making food. You know, about 50-60% of people worked on or near farms, or they knew somebody. Now it's like maybe 2% of the population, which means the other 98% of us have no idea where food really comes from. I mean, there are still children that are horrified when they find out where their chicken and beef comes from. Not us. I mean, we grew up around a farm, but a lot of people don't. And so when you're not aware of this stuff and you don't know where it comes from and you're just accepting what they give you as, yeah, you should eat this. I mean, and also there's nobody there to tell you there's anything wrong with it. So like the Wally scenario where they just got fatter and fatter and fatter, there was no voice of reason to say, maybe we shouldn't be doing it this way. That isn't healthy. Or, you know, this is not a good living. I mean, you got to assume the characters in that movie were living to 40 or 50 years and then just dying of heart attacks. And for us, it's kind of, we have a lot of this information and we still are obese. And that's what really frustrates me, is that this information is starting to get out about these things, these studies, these things that say, you know, all these things they told you about nutrition 10 years ago are wrong. And then we find out, well, the stuff they told you about nutrition 5 years ago was wrong. And all this confusion and all this obsession with it, and people are still really fat. And that's like the most visual way you can say to somebody, like, they're letting themselves go, they're atrophying. But there's also the intellectual atrophy, which is what Time Machine had, where people are getting dumber is not, I don't think there's got to be a better word than just dumber, but just less aware. And I think that's true now as well, that even though we have all this information, I still talk to people that just don't seem to be all that aware of what's going on around them. And I don't know if I know you've had the same experiences as well.
I mean, absolutely. I don't like to think that I'm in the minority of people that are like paying attention to what's happening in the world and what's going on. And I don't like to say like, oh, no one's paying attention, nothing happens, or... But when you talk to some people that you assume are at least paying attention to the very basic things that are happening in the world, and sometimes they don't, you know, they're not there on that tip, you realize that it is kind of possible that people, you know, they know more about reality TV people than they do about real politicians. And there is the option of all the information out there on the internet, you know, everyone being able to figure it out. So there is a way to... you know, maybe fix the problem, but there is still a cultural thing around people saying like, you know what, well, I'm not into politics. Like, you don't have to be into politics, you know, like, well, I'm not into like, you know, that whole eating that way thing. I'm not a health nut. Like, well, you don't have to be a health nut, you know, like all these different things that you don't necessarily have to be, these words and these labels that we put on things. When you could just look at it as just open access to information and learning.
I think the information is there. It's just we seem just not that interested in consuming it. I mean, we were joking around a few weeks ago. They were doing surveys of people who were involved in politics, and they asked them, you know, do you think the U.S. should bomb Agrabah? And I guess about... Yeah. A plurality or a majority of supporters of Trump said, yes, we should bomb Agrabah. The problem is, of course, Agrabah is a fictional city from the movie Aladdin. And yet people were just not aware of that. Or if you watch Jay Leno's like Man on the Street thing he does,
They've been doing that for years, and I'm sure they filter through. And like people answer it right, but you know, the unfortunate thing is that the information's out there and it's like really basic and everyone should kind of know it, and there's just a large amount of people that just aren't educated and don't know. And we think about in this time that we have all this technology that, you know, we should be getting better at educating people. People should be smarter than they were a generation ago, or, you know, two generations ago. And maybe not smarter, because, you know, maybe IQ is something that, I don't know, what'd you say about smarter, but still, like, we should get better at educating people. People should be more connected with the world. Because we have the opportunity to.
I think the other thing I don't want to really call anyone out, but I'm using politics as the example, because the two things that people kind of make fun of Americans for is around the world is that we know jack shit about geography, and that is true. I talk to people all the time; they don't know where these countries are. And, I mean, it's really hysterical, and then they have these preconceived notions about these countries. Based on, movies, usually, sometimes comedians, sometimes whatever. And I've had to tell people, and because I am a nut about geography, I'm totally into political science. So of course I'm the nerd that thinks I'm better than everyone else because I know this stuff, but it's not really about being better. It is, because some of this stuff is not important. It's not really that important that you know where the country of Mali is. I don't mean that. What I mean is to say that, for example, people think that Muslims have a problem with women, that they are anti-woman, they're anti-feminist, they believe in subjugating them, having them drive cars, they can't drive cars, they can't vote, and they have to stay in the house. And, you know, if they're raped, they have to marry their rapist, or sometimes they're punished, not the rapist. All these things are true of Arab countries. Arabs represent about, I think, one quarter of Muslims. The weird thing is that it was a Muslim country that elected the first female head of state, which I believe was Indonesia or Malaysia. I forget which. There's a lot of Muslims in other parts of the world that do not do any of these things, not even close. So to say that Muslims have a problem, and this is just one example, I know, and this is just kind of a buzz thing. The other things that you and I have talked about is, you know, for example, there's a lot of people that kind of like Bernie Sanders and they wanted to vote for him. But right now he's running for the Democratic nomination. And I guess you were telling me that a lot of people you were talking to, they're like, hell yeah, I'm going to vote for him. And it's like, well, you know, the election's in 2 weeks, right? Or 3 weeks, right? Because the primary was, what, March 1st in Colorado?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking to all your friends, and they all like Bernie Sanders. They're kind of energized by him. And they weren't aware that he was in a primary before the general election, and he had to win the primary to get to November. And it was like one of those things where, like, if you're in civics class in high school, you're aware of it. But, you know, as the years go on, you're not into politics. And so you don't really track those things that closely. And it's unfortunate because it's just another one of those facts. There's also just other things about, you know, the myths on Facebook, like the one about the wolves, you know, walking in a line and having their sick people in the front setting the pace, and, you know, just nonsense like that. And we have all this information, and yet we're still idiots, collectively. And you're right. It is an education thing. The way we educate people is obviously very out of date. But I think you also said this too, that there has to be a change in the culture as well, in particularly for us.
I mean, like, you know, what we end up valuing. I mean, you know, we'll value, I don't know, someone that's tough or someone that's strong or someone that defends, like, what we feel, you know, people should be like, and then we defend ideas, you know, that we think society should be like. But once we have those preconceived notions and those things that we hold dear to us, we don't care about the scientific method or whether it actually works or not. And we make excuses for why our beliefs or our ideas of how society should be run or how people should be run, why it didn't work, as opposed to actually looking at results and being like, you know what, maybe we should rethink how we're doing stuff, as opposed to just having it be personal about your cultural identity and embracing the scientific method that we obviously are all benefiting from modern technology and everything. And that's how we're getting all this information. So we should really like humble ourselves a little bit more and give in to the scientific method to improve our lives and to prove the way we do things. And I know that's not going to happen overnight. And I know it's like frivolous to bring it up now, but it's the beginning of the culture shift that probably needs to happen so we don't implode on ourselves, or maybe not implode, but end up being like the Wally civilization, end up being like the other one where we end up de-evolving too much because we have all this extra stuff.
You mentioned that that some things we accept as true become part of identity, become part of culture. Is there like that we're kind of using some jargon here to say that. Can you think of like an example of maybe a way that like where that happens, where somebody believes something is true, but it's really not based on evidence? Yeah, because I mean, it does happen. I'm trying to think of one myself. I know it happens because I remember for the longest time, trying to think if this fits. Well, the idea of, the war on drugs is the obvious one. There's no evidence to support being tough on drug users or drug dealers has had any impact on drug usage, demand, or even just has been better for us. There's no evidence of that.
But it feels really good to be tough on drugs, though, and it feels really good to be tough on crime. You know, it feels like that's like what we should be doing. But I mean, honestly, we don't even like look into the fact that we're perpetuating its system, and it's a system that exists like for itself. You know, the justice system, you know, kind of imploding on itself, and the fact that it doesn't produce real justice, it doesn't stop people from committing crimes. Because, you know, as you've told me, a very obvious thing that, you know, making laws doesn't stop that from happening. It actually just creates more criminals. And then putting people in jail doesn't actually rehabilitate anyone. And it's just a cycle that we have that ends up making everything worse. But it's really hard for us to break it from that because it feels right to punish people that have wronged us.
There's one. The tough on crime, where we feel like we don't need to put them in a humane situation when we put them in prison. And in fact, we need to find excuses to keep them in prison. I mean, I've seen this all the time. People want to say, well, people like this should, you know, not only go to prison, but, you know, they should be, you know, if they're a rapist, they should be raped themselves, you know, as if that was going to help anything. Or that the prisons that are just terrible conditions, it's like, well, then they shouldn't have committed crimes and they wouldn't be in that hell on earth prison. And those two notions are based on the idea of deterrence, that these things will deter criminals. Well, the evidence is that it doesn't. And I think that's what you were saying before, that we base it on this tough on crime idea that we need to deter criminals by being very strict and nasty in our punishment. But the empirical evidence is that's not the problem, and that's not working.
And that doesn't matter to most of us. That's actually okay with most of us, at least here in America. There are other places that have maybe embraced that fact that they won't give up on someone, even though they have the ability to keep someone in jail forever for the rest of their lives. They don't completely give up on them. So there isn't that hopelessness in committing crime, you know, that I'm going to be in jail for the rest of my life or I'm going to be executed. And then also the fact that, you know, justice isn't always right. We do screw things up, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're not infallible about it, and the fact that we could just kind of brush that off as collateral damage on our own people.
What about some of the positive things? Because I'm trying to think, because these are some of the negative policies we have that we need to either just repeal, eliminate, or whatever. But I mean, if we're talking about automation, where there a lot of these jobs are not going to be around, but we can't have it's not good for people. Obviously, we can't just have them sitting around because they clearly, even though they have all this information, they're not absorbing it. And a lot of us are becoming overweight and getting bad habits. So I guess, like, as a positive standpoint, some of the things that we would have, like if we were in millions of jobs are going to be automated by the year 2050 that are around today, they're not going to be around in 30, 40 years. They're just not going to exist anymore. And I guess the idea is, well, what are we going to do with those people that are out of work? And, you know, what kind of habits, you know, for somebody who doesn't have to work that much anymore, some of these jobs don't exist anymore. like, what kind of changes would we have to make? Because right now, the thinking is, well, they'll just have to get a different job, or they'll have to switch careers. They'll have to go to college and get skills in an area that they know nothing about. And I mean, that seems to be our current attitude, that everyone needs to work all the time. And if their job gets destroyed because a robot's doing it, well, tough. They'll just have to find a new one. The attitude that we have now is, and it's well-based because this is what our experience is that you work hard, you make a lot of money, then it's time to enjoy yourself, you know, see the world, you know, go on vacations, you know, go to distant places and start doing all these things you always wanted to do. But they're all basically recreation. That's mm-hmm. it.
And the mentality of actually like working for the better of society, or maybe, you know, putting something back in and helping other people with the resources you have. I mean, that's part of the mentality.
It is, but it's, yeah, but I just see a lot of people that think if they just throw some money towards charity, that's enough. And, or they pay their taxes. That's the biggest thing I hear is that you're helping people if you support, you know, large, you know, generous welfare programs and things like that, and you pay your taxes. Because I do, and maybe they don't say this out loud, but I do see a lot of people, especially because I do live in an affluent area. I'm not affluent, but I'm surrounded by people that have done very well. I think the Victorian era kind of required more of you. Mm-hmm. You know, they required you to not just write a check or say the right things at a party or to support the right policies in government. They required you had a responsibility for your little region, for them, it was like their what do you call it? Estate. Because they owned, usually the most wealthy people in England were landowners, and it's because they had a lot of land. But they were responsible for what happened on that land and for bettering that land and bettering the people on it. A lot of times they did not do that. That's absolutely true. England was not really a perfect place of equality and friendship and whatever.
Yeah, we're not talking about a golden era that's better than now.
No, it's a different set of values where you are required to affirmatively do something to better yourself, you know, to be a better contributor. And I think nowadays, like that, most people look at that as, well, you just need to give more money to charity. And I don't think that is what would have been acceptable in England at that time.
Well, I mean, another thing is a lot of emphasis on like personal character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And a lot of like values of around that and making like, you know, business decisions and decisions based on that, where in a lot of today's standards, you could be, you know, let's say a good father or a good mother or a good husband or wife or family member. But in business, you know, it's whatever. It's all holds bar. You know, there's not as much emphasis on, let's say, morals and ethics on the institutional level as there is, you know, on the personal level. And even that ends up getting neglected because, you know, you're only held accountable by the people, you know, personally.
Well, I know the one of the thinking now is, you know, the 40-hour work week and how France tried to do the 35 or 30-hour work week. And they passed these laws for maternity leave. And a lot of Americans just thought that was ridiculous. And a lot of free marketers also said it was bad for a government to enact those things. But because there's this general assumption that you're not really, you need to put in at least 40 hours a week. Now, the 40-hour work week, I think is something that came from an idea that was 80 years ago. And it's based on whatever was going on 80 years ago. I don't really think 40 is a magic number. But I do know, like, there's, you know, this thinking that you need to spend a certain amount of your time just working. And I mean, from people I know that work very hard, 45, 50 hours a week, when they're done working, they come home, all they want to do is relax and lay down. They don't have time to cultivate any additional skills. They don't learn a crap. They don't, learn, if they're into music, they don't learn the piano. They don't have any energy for it. They're exhausted. And I think there's something to be said in the older traditions, the Victorian era, where if you didn't have to work for a living, it was not acceptable for you to just spend that time and money just partying. Like, yeah, they did do that. I mean, they had balls. England had a lot of balls.
Yeah, they balled out.
Dude, balls all the time. Just
balls to the wall.
Balls. And some of the balls were really big. A lot of balls. I mean, very large. But they also were expected to, like, be cultural. Like, they had to learn music. They had to learn. They had to read. You know, they were expect when they went to these balls, they had to, you know, show their kind of knowledge of the world and what they were doing to contribute to the, you know, the greatness of the empire for them, because it was the British Empire. For us, like, we have a different attitude. If you have a ton of money, I mean, you can just do whatever the hell you want and nobody really expects anything from you. But there is kind of a shift where there are some people that kind of say, no, if you're wealthy, you know, you should try to do more. And also, if you are the head of a business and a corporation, you should conduct your business the way you conduct yourself in private life. And that's kind of something that, you know, I know that some of my conservatives would say is just hippie liberal crap. But I think in the era of automation, when a lot of jobs are going to disappear and a lot of people are going to be probably struggling with new, and really this, I'll do some stats real quick, or some things I know real quick about automation. One thing is, it doesn't lead to mass unemployment. It never has. It also doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to be worse off. In a lot of ways, automation has helped people because it makes things very cheap. At the same time, we are in a whole new era of what can be automated. We have never been able to do with robots and computers and machines today what we've in any point in history. And this is a whole new, you know, the theories of old were, I mean, the theories of capitalism and of free market, those are all from the 1700s and 1800s. They never would have envisioned an economy where a lot of the work, a lot of the physical labor, the manufacturing, the agriculture could be done by machines. And I think we need to start accounting for that more other than and doing that instead of just telling all those people that are about to lose their jobs, oh, just go get a new job. Just kind of bringing it around to, you know, instead of treating people like they're lazy slobs and they're living off the government dole, or they're not doing what they're supposed to just because they're unemployed. I mean, we have to start thinking differently that, you know, maybe some of these people are lazy slobs and are taking advantage and are intentionally just collecting welfare checks and sitting around. There are people like that. But I think it also, on the other side, if you're a wealthy person or you're doing very well, in this new economy where there's automation left and right, I mean, there should be some expectations on you to also, you know, not legal, but just, you know, cultural and just pure pressure that, look, you can't just sit around for the rest of your days and just party. I mean, you have all this time on your hands. Do something with it. But maybe that's just me.
I mean,
yeah, you and I were talking on the pre-show about the society that's portrayed in certain episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation and Star mm-hmm. Trek Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Now, it's not really explained, so this is not really a fully formed theory or fully formed kind of science fiction world, but they do suggest that in the future you have technology that provides for food, shelter, some of the basic necessities of life, that and these technologies are readily available, they're very cheap, they have replicators for food or materials. Nobody wants, because it's easy to build houses for people. It's easy to produce food for people. It's not a welfare program because it's so cheap. It's so plentiful. And so people have time on their hands. And so when you watch Star Trek, what are they doing with their time? Well, I mean, Commander Data is learning Shakespeare, you know, Captain Picard. I mean, they're all doing something with their time. They're not just, you know, partying all the time. Even back on Earth, there's an episode where somebody's grandfather runs a cafe. I mean, he's running a fucking cafe in the 24th century. And there's still people that are willing, not because he has to, because he has to pay his bills and everything that he needs that paycheck to pay for everything. He just wants to run a cafe. He wants to do that. And people want to go to a cafe that has a human server. So, I mean, that's kind of the Star Trek vision of the future, where we move forward to provide all these things through automation, through technology, because it becomes so cheap. And I don't know. I don't know how it's really going to work, and Star Trek never explains it, but I think it is possible.
No, it definitely is. And I think when you eliminate scarcity, and when you eliminate that, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's a mixture of that and also, you know, the unlimited ability for education. And education isn't always like, you know, thinking about the way that we have it now, because it still ends up being a rat race. It still ends up being something where it's like, oh, well, you have to get educated for this, or only makes sense because it costs this much money or that or whatever. But if you have, you know, whatever resources and you're okay anyway, and out of boredom, you could go take any classes and do whatever, and you're in a society that values that and wants people to do that, and you don't necessarily have to be an engineer or a scientist or this or that, you have, you know, access to education, and you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from or the roof over your head. And it seems really basic, and it seems really socialist, and it's not going to happen here overnight, but I think that's the beginning of a long run way for, you know, humanity to kind of stop some of these struggles that have plagued us for all of existence, you know, of our existence.
Yeah, you mentioned the words, because we usually associate these things with socialism, and really socialism just means that the means of production are run by a collective or the state. Socialism doesn't necessarily imply that the welfare programs are extremely generous, or that you have to have extremely, usually you do have to have extremely high taxes. I mean, generally that's how it works. But the idea that, you know, for example, what Scandinavia does is socialism. It's not really, I mean, they have very free markets. They have very minor limitations on trade, on business, on labor. And they were already very wealthy before they decided to make these welfare programs that they now have, that people cite as an example for the rest of us. And I think we need to maybe, and Bernie Sanders brings up Denmark and says how they keep take care of their people, and it's really, and the usual reaction is, well, that's because they're socialist. And it's like, they're not social. Denmark is not a socialist country. I can tell you that by the strict definition of that term, it is not. And I think in the future, right now they're expensive. Right now these kind of things are still expensive to provide, especially by the government, because the government is terrible at providing services at an efficient cost.
And it makes complete sense why we'd all be apprehensive to do it here in America. Like, it makes complete sense. It's expensive, and like you were saying, we don't always do it effectively.
No, we do it. In fact, we already spend hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars on social programs, domestic welfare programs, and we don't really, and people are not happy with them. So it's not really the dollar amount that's the problem. Mm-hmm. And in the future, I think that the one thing automation does do now, and it always has, is it brings down cost. And if you can bring down the cost of food with, say, a replicator, as Star Trek has, you know, that's like the end result. That's like the ultimate utopian device. But I mean, we've already brought the cost of food down to a pretty low level, and we could probably, with more automation and more technology, bring those costs to a minimal level. Well, that's great, but what, you know, where does that leave? I mean, if it's that cheap, then we should provide it for everyone. And actually, I think I was telling you about this, that there are two economists that are actually libertarian or conservative free marketers that have come out in favor of something called a basic income for all citizens. And it's an interesting idea where basically every citizen gets a certain amount of money.
Switzerland does it.
Do they really?
No, yeah, Switzerland does it. I think everyone has a monthly income that equivalents like $2,900 a month U.S.
They're
obviously they can afford it. I mean, they're very different and unique, but
yeah, and their programs are usually very direct in that they just give you the money. They don't really. What we do over here is we have a food stamp program where you have to jump through hoops to prove you're poor, and unemployment insurance and Section 8 housing and all these other things. You have to basically prove you're poor, or you're in a shitty. You basically have to prove that you're incompetent. I mean, that's really, it's a shaming almost. Mm-hmm. And what these economists have suggested, and really what some of these countries do differently than us, is that they will just give you support. Basic income support, not because you're poor, not because you're unemployed or because you're lazy, because you're a citizen. And that's their rationale.
I mean, that's dignity right there too. That's like
that's the difference.
It's like the difference is like giving you dignity and not trying to prove that you necessarily need this. And I mean, I've known a lot of people throughout my life, you know, throughout my entire life, that have needed help and there was help to be assisted, but were reluctant for a long time to get it because of the stigma around, like, you know what, I don't need that. I don't need that much of a hand. I'm not that person, because of the way they make you feel about getting some help or support. Like, oh, I'm not gonna, you know, get a food stamp because, you know, I'm not that bad, or I'm not in that bad of a situation. And it's like, mathematically, you're in a completely fine situation to take a food stamp. You should not feel bad for it. Or, you know, I don't know if I should get Medicaid or whatever, because I don't know if I've paid enough into it or something. And it's like, you know, there is some like morality and guilt to a lot of, maybe not morality and guilt, but what would the words be?
Well, I mean, I think shaming or guilt, I think, is actually probably on the ball.
Okay.
The other term, I wasn't sure what you mean by the other term, but I
think morality was, well, their morality is making them feel guilty and shameful. You know, it's coming from the right way. They're trying to be good people, but they've been conditioned to feel, you know, guilt and shame over, you know, something that maybe they're entitled to.
There's going to reach a point where there's, because right now, and the always idea in America is that there's always work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done, because we had to build a country out of a wilderness. And so that was always true. Mm-hmm. But with machines, with automation, there's going to be a point where there's really not that much work to do. And you can decide to shame everyone and just say, well, if you can't find a job now, it's because you're not skilled and you need to find a new skill. Or why don't we just acknowledge, because I mean, this is decades from now. This is not today. But I think we are going to reach a point where, because of technology, because of what we can do with machines and computers, that there's just not going to be that much work to do. And a lot of the work is going to be making sure that the machines and computers are running. And that's it. That's not going to be a 40-hour work week. And so we have to be prepared to kind of, I feel like we should be prepared to change the way we view people. And instead of shaming people and thinking, well, if you're unemployed for a long period of time, it's because you're lazy or you don't really want a job, because that might have been true in the 20th century. I think the more we become automated, I don't think that's really true anymore. And I think we need to change our expectations and kind of think, well, we don't want to make them feel like shit, but we also realize it's not healthy for them to just sit at home and watch TV all day and just get fat, which some Americans do. They collect welfare checks and sit on their ass. I know this for a fact. I've met them. Now, there's some things going on in Colorado that I found interesting, because one of the things I thought would be a cool little, you know, it's kind of something that people have to believe in to do, but that everyone, like, in their time tries to develop and have one kind of skill that is, you know, considered primitive. And I think, like, for Denver, for example, they're big into, like, urban farming and, mm-hmm. and learning how to farm. Now, they don't have to farm.
No.
But they're choosing to do it because, you know, they want to, for the health reasons, but also to learn, you know, a basic skill. And I think there's something to that, where you learn an advanced, you know, modern skill, but you also learn, you know, a basic skill as well.
I mean, and I also think it's, you know, really interesting, because we could solve a lot of modern problems with a lot more simple approaches. And I don't want to be completely tree hugger hippie on you, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you could just produce locally and doesn't take as much time and effort as it might seem, and could really make a, you know, bigger impact. And it doesn't have to be that big of a deal. It doesn't have to be that big of a culture shock or an even big shift. You know, just a few people getting together and changing it a little bit, and just, you know, urban garden is, I don't know, it's fun, and it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, change the way that we eat food or anything, but I don't know, just makes stuff easier sometimes.
Also, brewing your own beer, cheaper. Just saying.
I mean, that's a lot of fun too. I mean, there's a lot of other things are legally allowed to grow yourself here in Colorado and cultivate. And, you know, I just think that, you know, people should have a lot of those options in their own hands. You know, it's part of being human, being able to cultivate, do whatever you want, because in a lot of places they have water restrictions to the point where you can't collect your own rainwater and they don't let you grow your own crops in your own front yard. And I know there's homeowners associations and they're like, oh, well, you can only have this type of flowers or have that grass that needs to be watered or cut. But, you know, sometimes when you look at the bigger issue of it, it's about this independent freedom that we should all have as humans in our society to grow our own food on our own property.
Yeah, those rules blow me away. The other thing I was kind of thinking is, because we have a friend, or you have a friend who has all these kind of really kind of cool skills, Logan. And
yeah,
he, like, every time I hear about it, you know, you tell me about, you know, like, he's off, you know, hunting with his own bow and arrow. And I'm just like, of course he is. It's Logan. Yeah. And like, we joke, cause he's almost like the character Wilson from that show Home Improvement, where every time Tim Allen goes to his backyard, he's like, hey Wilson, what are you up to? And Wilson is always doing something, you know?
Yeah. It's like him meets, like, you know, the Dos Equis most interesting man in the world.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Kind of a blend between those two, where he's, you know, very educated and cultured, but at the same time, just doing amazing, fabulous stuff that is just larger in life. Well, I think one of the Thanksgivings that I asked him what he was doing for Thanksgiving, he's like, well, you know, the one that you're referencing, well, I made my own longbow, you know, from scratch. And then I went, you know, hunting for turkeys and I shot a few, and then we had that for, you know, Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, really. It's like, wow, Logan, well, I went to the store and bought a turkey and brought it home with some prepackaged seasoning. So that's what we did.
I shot a bow and arrow in the parking lot and had to leave really abruptly, but
yeah, cops showed up.
Just for you, man.
Well, the survival stuff that, I mean, a lot of preppers like, I'm not into the, you know, the government's about to take over, New World Order, Illuminati stuff. But I do also think there's something to maybe learning more about just, you know, basic survival skills. Like, you know, once in a while, just make it a weekend or something and just do it. And also, you know, learning, you know, I'm a Second Amendment person, so I feel just everyone should basically know how the hell guns work. Even if you don't plan to own one or ever use one. You know, it's stuff like that. I mean, it's you know, filtering your own water. I mean, it's like basic survival. Like, it's stuff that you'll probably never use. I'm not saying, like, we're on the verge of an apocalypse and you need to know this stuff, or, you know, like, some of this stuff, I would say, you know, it's actually kind of fulfilling to know some of these, really, so to know that if shit fell apart, you actually would be semi-okay. Like, you actually have a chance. Because right now, I know that I have no chance. I have a bunch of friends that are preppers and veterans, like, a Marine Corps and whatever. I've basically told him, like, dude, if things ever fall apart, I'm going to find you guys and just be like a hopeless dependent. You know, I'll just be like your houseboy because I don't have any skills.
Well, you know what? I mean, I think all the listeners out there could really take comfort in the fact that he probably doesn't believe this is going to happen, because if he did, he wouldn't be encouraging other people to know survival skills, because that would just lessen his odds, because resources are going to be at a limited
amount. That's true.
You know, so, like, why do you want everyone to be good at survival? It's just going to make shit harder.
It is. I don't want competition.
Yeah, so, I mean, he obviously doesn't think it's very likely, but it is definitely a fun activity. You know, and it's a great way to stay in shape.
What's some of the other things they do in Denver? I know, I mentioned the urban gardening, but I know they do, because they're very big into environment and kind of renewable, whatever, because I know Logan, for example, I think it is Logan that does the solar panels on houses and stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, the painting company that he is a partner with is also spreading a lot of it, obviously, into all different types of home repair and exterior stuff, as well as installing solar panels. I think we're going to be the largest solar market in the country, especially since Nevada kind of shot itself in the foot. Purposely about messing up its solar market, but I don't know enough about that to continue. But some of the other I would say maybe more progressive stuff we do is, I don't know, we try to know where our food is coming from, but we're definitely all guilty of, you know, our guilty pleasures. One of the refreshing things about, you know, the people here is like, you know, we try to, you know, live a better lifestyle, but everyone knows that it's not, you can't do it 100% all the time. You know, you can't be like a vegan with a stick up your ass and never eat an animal product, because you know what we do? We drink craft beer, you know, it's fucking delicious. And, you know, everyone tries to be all healthy and stuff, and we do all this healthy everything, but like we have beer that is literally like 1,000 calories in a pint or something. It's like insane. And we still manage a way to be healthy. But you
definitely are. I know the obesity rate in Colorado is half of what it is in most of the rest of the country. And I've been to Denver and I've been to parts of Colorado that's very in shape, good looking people, big on going outdoors. Of course, if you live in Colorado, who the hell wouldn't want to go outdoors? I mean,
it's just sunny all the time and it's gorgeous everywhere, like all the time. You really have to, you know, be a recluse. And I mean, it's just easy to do, like, you know, the city lifestyle and do all of that stuff and also be outdoorsy and do all the other things as well. And just people kind of just think about taking care of themselves more, what they eat a little bit more. And I think when that's more of the standard, like kind of what we're talking about, like education and like, you know, like what is more of the standard, it's a little bit easier to do it. And I mean, we both grew up in the Midwest where that's like one of the farthest things in your mind. And if someone talks about it too much, you almost want to lecture them because you want your lack of like health values to win over someone else that, you know, is a health nut. As we put it, like, oh, you're a health nut. Like, that's like a weird thing that you could be a nut about that's like something you could be crazy about. What makes a lot more sense is being an unhealthy person and that being nutty.
Some of these things that, you know, they seem like they're primitive and it's kind of hipster stuff to do, but if you think about it in the future, and a lot of things that we teach now are going to be worthless. And you're going to have to do something with your time. And really, a lot of this stuff, even though it's not necessary, it's really fulfilling. Like, growing your own food, I haven't done it yet, but like I can imagine how fulfilling it is to know that everything you just put on the table, you grew. Or if you can repair your own house, you don't have to call someone to come repair your damn house. Or the energy that you have solar panels on your house, you don't have to pay an electric bill. Like, you, it's all, and if the power goes out or a nuclear power plant gets blown up, all these things, I mean, we're just kind of using the examples of what, you know, Denver does and what some of the common things that, you know, people that do this stuff, they get made fun of, you know, for being fucking vegan hippies or just being, you know, paranoid, you know, conservative preppers that think the government's out to get them. And so there's, I mean, it's on both sides. It's not conservative or liberal, and that, I guess that's the point I'm making, is that
it's definitely a good point to say that it does transcend like the political, you know, bias, or, you know, it's not, because you're right, because on one side, you know, there's the doomsday preppers or whatever that are trying to think about a simpler time, and then on the other side there's the people that are trying to grow their own food and make their own food and everything that are thinking about a simpler time. And you know, they could all end up meeting somewhere. All those skills are still valuable. And I think of a future where, I don't know, we all are connected to that stuff a lot more, even if we have technology to make everything easier and better for us. You know, just maximizing and optimizing on that, and still just not like losing knowledge. And I mean, there's a lot of fun in like perfecting stuff too, you know, like that's part of the reasons why we have amazing wines and scotches and whiskeys and beers and things, because like, you know, monasteries had endless resources and endless time to perfect stuff.
Yeah, dude, scotch, that took a while. I mean, yeah, they were committed. Like, it took forever for them to get that recipe right to the way we make it now. And it was trial and error for, I think, centuries, man. And it was worth it.
And then, of course, there's going to be that segment of the population that isn't going to challenge itself and it's just going to kick it. And like, what's the harm in that? That's not the worst thing ever.
Yeah, that I guess that's the other thing, that not everyone is, it's like the Mitt Romney thing where he was like talking to entrepreneurs, like as if all of us are dying to start a business and have this wonderful idea that's going to make us millionaires. Like, no, some of us just want to chill and don't want to hurt anybody. We don't, or, and I'm not saying we, because I shouldn't say we, because I don't really want to sit back and chill. I do want to do some things, but at the same time, I understand.
I'm really ambitious. I will crush anyone that stands in front of me.
Yeah, that's right. from where I stand, you are all ants. But no, you're right. Like, if we reach a point where somebody who just doesn't really want to work that hard and just wants to sit around, be like, all right, fine, you can live in a basic, you know, housing unit, and you have enough money to feed yourself, healthcare is free, and if we reach that point in technology where we can provide all those things and not have to tax people to death, because that's really what the problem is now. We try to provide these things, but we're bad at it, and we charge ridiculous amounts of money for it. Technology might make it possible in 50, 60 years, or maybe even sooner, to provide for that slacker, and it won't really bother anyone because it's only going to be a few pennies on the dollar compared to what we spend now.
I mean,
there's, as long as they're doing no harm, because that's kind of the one philosophy is that, well, if their idle hands are the devil's playground, it's like, well, I don't really believe that's as true as people say. I know people that are very lazy and they're slackers. They don't hurt anybody, and they never have. And I don't. So I guess there should be a place, especially like in Star Trek, for example. Not everyone can be the captain of the fucking Enterprise, or an engineer like LaForge, or be like a high-powered scientist on the Enterprise or Starfleet or whatever. That's not for everybody. And in the future, that might be like the only jobs left that machines can't do are going to be the ones where you need to be very talented, very smart, and very, very committed. And guess what?
I mean,
not the majority.
they still have like ensigns to be human shields.
Yeah, but they have to go to Starfleet Academy, though, I think. Like, even ensigns have to do that. So, like, even their lowly, like, human shields have to, like, get accepted to their damn academy.
You know, like, to be really good at something when you already had a leg up and you had more resources and more, you know, opportunity, like, are you really that much better than someone that was smarter than you that had no opportunity but still didn't quite reach where you were, but is honestly still better than you?
I was thinking of it. I think I know what you're saying. And I was thinking of our great uncle, our grandfather's brother, Dale. Uh-huh. He was a gifted musician. And when I say, and I'm taking this from family stories, and so because I never met him, of course, but he was a gifted musician. But when he was growing up, musicians did not make any money. So he basically went into whatever jobs he could find, and he wasn't really particularly good at any of those jobs. And he was, you know, got a reputation as being kind of a slacker, a brawler. He became a boxer for a while. And he never really did a whole lot with music because he had to do all these other things to make a living. And I think back to, you know, back in the day in the Renaissance or in the early industrial era, where artists needed a patron. They needed somebody to commission them, to pay them to do their work, because otherwise they would just be on the street and either dying, or they'd have to get a factory job or work in the fields. And you just have to imagine, like, how many Mozarts had to work in the fields, you know, before the Enlightenment, or even today, like, how many talented people have to give up on something that they could make that would be really, really special and change the world. But since they have to pay the bills, they're a bartender, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, there is a lot of things that, I mean, especially now, are getting stacked against people that even have the ambition to try and better themselves. And now, as opposed to thinking about trying to better themselves of what that are best at in life and having that, you know, make them money, you have to think about what jobs are actually available and what you can actually do for a living and what might actually, you know, pay you any money. And it doesn't really have to do with what you're good at anymore. I mean this has already existed for a long period of time, but there's not like a golden era where it's like, oh well, if you're, you know, good at, you know, like I don't know, sign language or whatever, you'll go to a sign language school and you'll be the best at sign language ever. Like, I don't know. at the same time, like, we're definitely in an area where it's disproportionately where it doesn't really matter what you're good at. It's just what the hell you could try and study and find a job in, what might make sense for you.
We could also talk about the great inventors of the last few centuries. A lot of them, they had an opportunity to do this stuff because somebody allowed them to, whether it was their family, because their family had money and they didn't need to work, or there was a patron like, you know, like the Medicis in Italy, or, you know, they just came across money, or maybe they didn't care. They lived in a shack for a while and their family and people supported them.
That does sound awful. I mean, I live in Denver. It's a city of a lot of artists. I live in a neighborhood filled with a lot of artists, and it's really, like, you know, exhausting for them to be like, oh, come to my opening. Come see me DJ. Come see me spin. Come see me do this. Come see me do that. So, yeah, I could definitely see that just being, like, the worst, but... like a whole world of that. Jesus. But, I mean, I guess what it just comes down to is... you know, trying to get humanity to the point where, like, that's, you know, your biggest problem, you know, where we could just kind of end scarcity and kind of end at least the basic amount of suffering. We can't make it a utopia that ends all suffering, but just to have some sort of rule stick of humanity and human decency that we hold ourselves, that it's higher than we ever have before. And we've talked about it in public policy. We've talked about it in the history books and, like, democracy and our founding fathers and all this stuff about human dignity, but really practicing it on a global scale and really having at least a barometer of, like, people's comforts and people's dignity, so they won't be starving, they won't be sick, they won't be forgotten. And maybe if they have a random interest in anything, regardless of what their IQ points are, they can at least better themselves some way by studying something.
Indeed. And I think it, well, do you have anything? Are you guys almost done?
I was going to say, it's not a bad goal to have. I don't know how long it's going to take. And we got 7 billion people and we've never been able to do anything that consistently for anything. So, you know, but it's not a bad goal.
Well, I mean, if you compare to what we were doing in the 1900s or 1850, I mean, we've made a ton of progress, but yeah, you're right. We're still pretty far back. And I think, I mean, I guess the overall story of this is, you know, automation is not something to be feared, because a lot of the things we're talking about are going to be possible because there's going to be a machine doing the gritty work. You know, there's going to be robots that are going to be working the coal mines, not people. And I think that, I mean, there's an opportunity here to really advance, you know, humanity, take away a lot of suffering and take away a lot of the stuff that, you know, and it won't, and take, bring the cost down to just do some of the most basic things for our fellow man. Right now, the way we do it is ass backwards and it's expensive. And I think we could do a better job, like, you know, right now, right away. But I do understand some of these things are only going to be possible with certain technological innovations, you know, and like you and I have said here, like, we need to do a better job of, you know, taking not just, you know, the educational system, but also just on our own. Taking our own initiative to realize that we have a great opportunity with the time we're given. And so this automation, the war against the machines, like, it can actually help us build, not the war, you know, not, but I mean, automation in general could really be something that takes us to the next step as a race, turns us into, you know, Wall-E or the movie Metropolis, where only some of us get to enjoy this and the rest of us are unemployed and have to take the most remedial, demeaning, and humiliating jobs. I mean, there's an opportunity here to be more like Star Trek and less like Wall-E. And I think that's the gist of what we spent a lot of this saying. And we covered a lot of ground here and probably got off topic quite a bit. But this is actually a much broader topic than what I said at the beginning. And we'll try to maybe be a little bit more disciplined in the next few. But anyway, I think that's the best way to sum it up. John, anything to add or throw in there?
Well, no, I want to apologize as well as you were for how off topic we got. And the next one is going to talk more about, like, the actual war with the machines. But I mean, you know, there's probably so much more you wanted us to talk about when you're thinking about War with the Machines, but this is just so much society, public policy, what's the worst that could happen before, like, you know, we haven't even I don't even think we said AI once.
No, actually, so. Exactly. And I think what I'm going to say for the next few episodes is the next one is going to be more about AI, and it's going to be more about, you know, creating something that, like from the movie Blade Runner, something that looks human, and then we start asking, what does it mean to be human? And then, of course, we have to talk about the fears of robots turning on us, like Matrix or Terminator 2, or in some of the fears from the iRobot stories. So we will get into some of the more mainstream, you know, fear of machines and fear of AI in the next few episodes. This one was the soft one. I started off with the soft one kind of intentionally. So, but yeah, definitely it'll get a little bit, it'll get much harder after this, and we'll get darker.
No, I mean, but I think we should definitely, you know, talk about the beginning, because so much, like, you know, jumps too many light years or too many generations ahead. So,
all right. Well, all right, that'll do it for Thought Crime on this episode, on the next episode. Actually, normally I would usually do a joke here and tell you that we're going to do something crazy, like tell you how to, you know, speak to dead relatives, or, you know, teach you how to make your own warp drive. But actually, I'm just going to straight up tell you that the next episode we will be talking about the concerns of artificial intelligence and the concern of what it means to be human, especially when, you know, we have the ability to upload a human mind onto a computer and things like that. So that'll be the topic for the next episode. So tune in, and until then, have a good one.